You are now tuned in to the Nancy Ruffin Show.
So joining me tonight is the incomparable Roya Marsh. She is a Bronx, New York native and a nationally recognized poet, performer, educator, and activist. Roya is someone who I absolutely am a fangirl of. There's no other way for me to say it. So Roya, thank you for agreeing to be on and for being a guest. How have you been?
I've been well. I could complain, but I will opt to choose joy in this moment. Working, honestly, trying still to figure out the best way in which to do the kind of work that I do in my home space. Haven't figured out the best remedies, but I'm getting close.
Listen, it's been such a difficult year for so many people, right? Like COVID, first of all, it's like a ton of things that have been like compounding on each other.
Yes.
It's been COVID. Then we, you know, everything that's been happening. Well, this has been happening for years. You know, we've seen the killing of Black people just all the time, everywhere. That the protest, just so much. Then we had this crazy election with this crazy president. And the fact that I think any of us have survived 2020,
right,
is a big deal.
Absolutely. Right?
How have you been navigating the new normal?
I will say that it feels least normal for me to have to interact with young people, which is the population that my work centers, through this virtual workspace. Simply dealing with the topics that we're addressing, but also considering the ways that they have been affected by this pandemic, by being locked in the house, surrounded by their families, which are not necessarily the most ideal situations and living scenarios. And so trying to investigate or even assess what level of mental health and wellness each particular student is at has been a challenge. And then after that, trying to assist them in compartmentalizing these issues. Say they want to write a poem about one thing, but something very immediate is happening in their household and it's burrowing its way into the poem and it's not allowing whatever the meat of the poem is supposed to be to come to light, right? So then we have to like section these things off and figure out what issues we're actually trying to address and trying to tackle, or who our intended audience is in that moment. Different ways to get the young person to center themselves. I would say for my personal life, I'm back and forth between considering this normal and considering the irregularities that exist. I'm home almost all the time, which pre-COVID was totally okay, because I love to play the crib. Now it's like, when this is the place that I guess I'm supposed to be, I'm just kind of like, wow, I really wish I could just pick flags. I really wish I could, you know, do this.
It's so funny because it's true. I'm a homebody too. Like I don't go anywhere unless it's directly related to like the work that I'm doing. I'm not someone that's ever out, but now that I have to be home, it's like, wow, I really wish I could go do things that I wasn't even thinking of doing pre-COVID. And so it's like they say, like you don't know what you have, right?
Yeah.
Until it's gone, or until they tell you you can't do something, like that's when you want to do it more.
Absolutely.
I guess that's a part of human nature. But, you know, it's been a struggle for so many. And I think, as you mentioned, particularly for the younger people, and I think even more specific teenagers, right? That group that really, first of all, they're coming into their own, right? So they're in a phase of their life where they're trying to discover who they are, trying to find their way in the world. But now their world has been confined now to their home. And yeah. No teenager, no matter, even if you're in the best home situation, yeah. No teenager wants to be home.
I mean, I have so many young people right now, just a cluster of them that are like facing some form of regression in terms of like their work ethic or other things, simply because they were supposed to start college. So they were so like enthralled in this idea of having a new life away from high school, away from families. And now it's just like, nah, we're on the computer. So they lost, you know, work, or folks who actually had to pick up work because their parents or guardians lost work.
I know.
So, like, I was living in this very comfortable space, and now I go to school, I go to work, I have to care for my siblings. It's so many different layers that are adding on.
Let me ask you this. Do you feel that all of those things considered is adding to the, I guess, the depth of what they're writing in the poetry, or is it affecting it in a way where it's not allowing them to get there?
I think that it's a catch-22. It's like a gift and a curse for a lot of them equally. Some folks have had their writing styles explode because they've been home. They've been able to focus. They've been able to zone in and hone their craft. And right. then other folks are literally just locked in this box of what was supposed to be or what could have been. And so now they're just like, well, I was trying to write this, but then I turned on CNN, and then my mother said, and then my abuela came over, and then she said, now I'm thinking about toxic masculinity. And I'm like, wait a minute.
We were
writing a poem about climate change. Wait a minute.
The only reason why I asked that is because I know specifically for poets, you know, we write what we're living. You know, it's the language that we best know how to communicate, like what we're feeling. And so I just wondered that, given all of the madness, you know, if they've allowed themselves to tap into it in a way that just, I guess, accelerates you know, their work.
And so I don't want to just focus on the ills. Some of my young people are applying to Button Poetry's chatbook contest, right? So they've been like reaching out for kind of edits on their manuscripts. I have a young person who actually just had a book come out. I don't remember the name of the press, right? But it's like there are young people who are utilizing this moment, especially young people who are already in college, right? So yeah. Now the workload for them has somewhat lightened. And so they're like, oh, all right, cool. Well, let me get this book out. Let me put this together and see, you know, who has the availability to read, to edit, and things like that. So it's definitely been a gift and a curse.
What have you learned about yourself as an educator, right, as a result of this?
Wow, that's a phenomenal question, Nancy. I think the most important thing I learned is how deeply impacted I am by the interpersonal relationships that I'm allowed to build with young people, right? And it's like mental and physical, right? When I walk into a space, you know, they see me with my chain on, but they, right now, they can see my chain, right? Maybe they see my hat, shirt, t-shirt combo. But in the real world, they're looking at my shoes first and they like, damn, yo, those are friends. All right, huh? All right. Maybe this is somebody who understands the world a little bit more like I do, right? But also like being able to just look at people and see what they're doing and have them raise their hand or have them like be excited. There is definitely something that is missing in this virtual space in terms of interconnectedness. And I learned how much I was thriving from that in the real world. So now I'm trying my hardest to figure out ways to implement that into the work that I'm doing online. Also that there were a lot of relationships in terms of like friends and like coworkers, former colleagues that I realized were not only not serving me, but were also in some ways manipulative and abusive. And I think the space allowed for those things to come out. And it's somebody that, you know, you love dearly, right? That doesn't change. But when you stop seeing them, or you stop talking, or the conversation alters, right? Or you have that space where it's not just, well, I just want to go hang out with my friends, because we are not supposed to just be going to hang out with our friends. Then you start wondering, like, well, what was I getting from that relationship? What were the benefits, you know? And so having just the time and the space to consider that. And I think for me, I spent so much time giving and loving and wanting to be helpful. And in this space and time, I've had the opportunity to give and love and want to be helpful to myself. Ooh. And that's been very dope, very beneficial for me, I would say.
I think that that's an amazing realization, you know, to have come to during this time. Because I think we get so busy just with our everyday lives, right? With just routine and just doing whatever it is that we do, that we don't allow ourselves the time to just kind of step back from those things. And like you said, really interrogate the relationship, you know, and then when you find that there's distance there, and so you're not, and then you're not spending time the same way. It's like, well, wow, well, what was I doing then? What were we doing, you know, the time that we were together? I think that that's really powerful. Because what it does, it helps you now really when, I guess, when things go back to whatever the new normal is going to be, and we're back connecting with people, you know, in a real way where we're in their presence, it now has shown you where to better invest your time, right? Because time is a resource that we don't get back. And so if we're spending it with people that now we realize weren't really benefiting us in any way, then that was time you were wasting, right? That you could have invested somewhere else doing something that was going to benefit Roya.
Absolutely.
So we talked a little bit, small talk. I want to, because I will be honest, I have followed your work. I have watched your YouTube videos. You know, I don't know much about Roya the person aside. I mean, I learned a lot about you, I think, in your book.
In the book. Oh, yeah. Yep.
I have here, and I have all my stickies because I had like specific pieces that I was just like, wow. So I want to know, when did you know that you were a poet? Like, when did you come to that realization?
Wow. I feel personally that I was very young. I didn't have a name for it. So poetry wasn't really a word or a term that was used in the circles that I was navigating, but I had been writing since I was 9. And then when I was in high school, we had a fashion show and they were like, hey, we need some entertainers to like perform while I went to an all girls high school. So while the girls are changing and everybody was like, oh, you know, this person sings, this person does this person. Hey, Roya, don't you? And I was like, no, I don't. I most certainly do not. And so at some point with a lot of encouragement, I allowed myself to share on stage. And this was like 2005, 2006. So Kanye was fresh out, backpacks like Louis Vuitton was in, polo shirts with the collars popped, right?
I remember that.
I was on stage. I was in the fashion show also, because I've always been into fashion. So I like was on stage. I had my backpack on. I had some jeans like rolled up to my shins with some Vans on. And I was reading a poem. And I don't know if it was because I was already pretty popular in high school or if it was because I was actually good at reading and writing poetry. But I read it. And the reaction that I received was, I think, so transformative for me to have this art that I had been hiding from people, including my own like family. My sister and her best friend, maybe I was like 13 or 14, they had found a notebook that I was writing poems in and they were making fun of me. So after that, I was just like, oh, well, clearly this is corny.
Right.
And I'm supposed to keep to myself. Maybe this is just my diary, right?
Right.
So then at that point, when I was 17, I was like, are people like this? And then I let it go again. And then in college, I was working for our periodical called Kaleidoscope Mag. And I was editing all types of people's work. And one of the presidents of the organization was like, hey, Roya, why don't you submit your own stuff? And I was like, no, I'm good. Nobody wants to read what I've got. Then he actually showed me a video on YouTube of these artists who were doing spoken word. And it was very similar to the Deaf Poetry Jam that we had watched on HBO years prior. But for me, I was looking—
You've also been on—
Right.
We'll talk about that. That has to be like a full circle for you, right? But go ahead, continue with the story.
So we were watching this YouTube video, and I was like, oh, this is like a younger person, like me. And I was like, oh, yeah, like we are. Because in my mind, it was like, you either a rapper or that's it, you know? And so actually, in my first graduate experience, being in the Lower East Side, I had met some artists that were like, oh, hey, we're going to go to an open mic. And I was like, all right, cool. So I pulled up, I shared. That open mic turned out to be a slam. And when I won that, which was my first experience, I had no idea what it was. The host— Wow. —was like, do you have another poem? And I was like, I mean, yes, but why? He was like, you made it to the second round. And I'm like, the second round of what? And then like, oh, well, this is what this is. And then when I won that, they were like, yeah, so you're going to be in our finals. And I'm like, finals of what? So this was at the Nexus Lounge. It's called the One in One, which is on First Street and in the Lower East Side. And oh my gosh, a ton of like white people. So this was what I thought. And everybody there, there were maybe five people who were referring to themselves as poets. Everybody— mm-hmm. —there was also a comedian. So like my open mic space and even beginning slam experience was like, not a lot of people do this.
Right.
There's five of us. So I guess this isn't a big thing. But I think that was definitely like, the awakening for me. I would say the genesis was when I was in high school and I shared on stage for the first time. But the awakening for me, meeting more people, joining different circles, and then finally making my way in 2013 to like the New Eurekan, which opened up an entire new world for me, was like when I began to call myself that, because other people were saying it. Next poet to the stage. And I was like, yo, what's up? I'm just Roya. You know, in a space where people were like, yo, we want a bio. What do you want to say? And I'm like, just write, Roya is here. Like, that's it. And it was, you know, people be like, even advocate of words, like, Roya, you're so modest. I'm like, bro, I'm not modest. It just feels like I don't deserve, you know? And so,
let's talk about that, because we do that to ourselves, right? Even as dope as you are, if whoever is listening, watching right now, if y'all have never seen this woman spit on a stage, please do yourself a favor and go on YouTube and Google her. And I promise you, you will never be the same again. But I want to ask, like, how then do you break out of that to really own your power? Because the poetry, you being able to step on a stage, that is your power, that is your gift. And the fact that you were able to step on, you know, the first open mic and win that slam, I mean, if that in itself is not like confirmation that says, you got something here, sis, what you gonna do with it now? Right?
Yeah, it was really, I would say, a combination of the community, so people, which I'll name Mahogany L. Brown, Jive Poetic, Jennifer Falu, Whitney Greenaway, Ebony Hogan, who affirmed my purpose. Mm. I knew that there were words, which is why I was writing them. And I knew that there was potential that someone would want slash need to hear it, which is why I was saying it out loud. I didn't at that moment believe that it needed to come from me. I didn't see myself even as a vessel. I was just like, these things are coming and this is fun.
Right.
I didn't even necessarily know how liberating it was, right? So a combination of the community and then therapy, right? To realize which moments were self-hatred, which moments were self-doubt, which moments were self-deprecating. And those are different things, right? And so which moment was it where I was going to be able to allow myself to be actualized for me, right? Self-actualization, not just the room full of people saying, wow, that's amazing. Keep doing what you're doing, right? But for me to understand that there was a reason why I was doing it, what that reason was, and why I needed to continue, right? And I think a great portion of the work that I'm actually even doing now, right, which is facilitating workshops for young and old and encouraging folks to tell these truths, even if they only post it as a Facebook status or an Instagram caption, right, is that when these things are consistently living inside of us, our actions, our behaviors, our mentality become cyclical. And we're keeping ourselves, right, in this box, in this cycle where this wheel is spinning and spinning and spinning, but there is no new destination, right? And so I had to allow myself to find those new destinations, right? To let my bio be read aloud and to smile and nod and say, yeah, yo, I did that. Like, I really did, you know? Yes. And also to remember that I didn't do it alone and that I didn't have to. And that was definitely something I learned as an adult. For a long time, that whole Miss Independent thing was me convincing myself that no one was there to assist and no one would want to assist. And both of those things were false.
Yes. You said, I have a list of questions that I don't even know if I'm going to get to just because the way that the conversation is so organic, which is what I always love. You know, I prepare my questions just because I like to be prepared.
Right.
But this conversation that we're having is so important. You touched on, you know, mental health, healing, going to therapy. How critical really was that for you to really affirm and step into your purpose? Like, do you think you would have been able to do that had you not healed and gone to therapy?
I think I would have been able, no. I think I would have been a facade, a smoking mirror, because I probably would have been doing drugs and having all other types of wild vices, right? Which are very easy to become dependent on when you have so many voids, right? And I'm very understanding of that. For me, I will say that therapy is one of the greatest reasons why I'm still here, right? Allowing somebody who doesn't know me from a hole in the wall to not only affirm me, right? But to listen and to call me out and to call me in objectively, to also help me figure out what the genesis was of all of the self-hatred, the self-doubt, the self-deprecating that I mentioned before that was stunting my poetry career, but was also stunting me and my own personal growth, right? And to think about challenging myself to have conversations with humans as opposed to just having conversations with pen and paper, right? Which is a lot of what I was doing and a lot of what I see other people doing, young and old alike, right? There are definitely scenarios where you can't say a thing to a person based on maybe they're no longer living, maybe you have no way to contact them, maybe it's just completely unsafe for you to do so, yes, right? But for me, there were times where the thing that I needed to say, the conversation that I needed to have was with the person who was sitting across from me at the dinner table. And I was like, well, let me just hit the books. Right. And then I'm writing this and I'm saying this to everyone in the world. And they're like, wow, you're so brilliant. You're so brave. And I'm like, am I brave? Because I see this person weekly, nightly, and I can't muster up the courage to say these things. Right. Mm-hmm. So then in those moments where the therapist and the counselors are giving tools to have these conversations, conversation starters, like sentence starters, even markers, questions on capacity and consideration, right? So fielding where someone else is, as opposed to just assuming I'm going to dump all of these things that I feel on you and you deserve it, right? Or holding in all of the things that I'm thinking and I'm feeling until a moment where they eat my leftovers and now I'm exploding on them.
Right.
Because I'm carrying all of the things, right, that I'm feeling.
Yes.
And there's no way for me to center what one topic is, right? And so definitely also just like grounding techniques and centering, like when I'm feeling overwhelmed, to be able to even embark on the writing and or the real life conversations, right?
Yeah.
So that I'm not, you know, rambling or overly internalizing and, you know, ending up harming myself because of what someone else is doing.
Right. And I think that that's probably one of the biggest takeaways that therapy gives us, right? It really allows us to learn how to communicate in a way that is helpful to us, because we do so much damage to ourselves when we internalize those things. And so much of what we internalize have been things that we ourselves have not caused, right? That we're not responsible for, that someone has put on us. And then, like you said, we carry that with us everywhere we go, in our lives, in our work, our art, like all of that. And all of it does a disservice to who we are and who we could be, you know. And I'm a huge advocate for therapy, for talking, for doing the work, for really holding up that mirror to yourself and saying, wait a minute, this, what I'm doing is not healthy and it's destructive. How can I fix this? You know, and I ask it because I think it's important that more of us just be open with what, like, our journeys were, because so often people see the end result, right? They see all of the amazing work that you're doing, all of the recognition, the accolades, like all of it. But what they don't see is all of the behind the scene work that you had to do in order to get to where you are. And so I always say there's no easy way out, right? The only way out to get out into the world, to step into your purpose, is by going in and really looking at who you are and then assessing where you want to be and then say, okay, well, what is the work now that I have to do to get there?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so we went a little deep there. But let's talk about, you know, the moment that you stepped on that deaf poetry stage, right? As a person who was doubting if that path was for you, you didn't want to share your work initially, then you step into this world, you find that you are a phenomenal slam poet, writer, people really want to hear more of Roya, and then you end up on deaf poetry, which is a huge, you know, I think, accomplishment for any poet. What was that like for you?
I have to be honest. Definitely, I was definitely in awe. It was definitely a transformative moment. At the same time, I was also doing what everyone told me I was supposed to be doing. And I don't have any regrets about it at all. But I do say that to say, I don't feel like I was totally in control at that moment. Right? I definitely, for a long time, felt like there was not room. There wasn't any room for me to say no to things. And Mahogany, Mo Brown, actually was one of the first people to talk me out of that, right? And it wasn't even just, it was definitely a lesson in boundaries, but it wasn't just that for me. It was so much more. It was also affirming for someone to be like, you know your worth. And so give room for other people to respect that and see what the benefits of it are, right? Yeah. So being included, right, with the amazing legendary artists who have been included and who have shared that stage were beautiful. It was just a very beautiful moment. And I think it was also really important for me to recognize that other people thought that I had some talent, star quality, a fierce pen, all the things that I wanted people to believe that I had. And I was like, oh, all right. Okay, cool. Let's see what's next, you know? Right. And a lot of dope mentors were like, yeah, you know, where you headed? Like, we want you back, or we want you to also do this thing, or we want you to also do, I mean, I was young when that right. came out. So the fact that like I have Sheehan's real phone number, like he texts me like, yo, we have this, that, and the third going on. It's still in 2020, unbelievable to me, right? Yeah. So I'm just like, all right, cool.
Let me ask you something. Yeah. Do you think you're dope?
Now, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
But I am still also extremely insecure. When I write something new, I send it to two or three artists that like I revere, and I'm like, tear it up. And there have been times where they've given me beautiful edits. Then there have been other times where they're like, no, Roya, like, this is beautiful. Only thing I think maybe it needs is an epigraph at the top. And I'm like, no, but I want the, okay, seventh line, third stanza. when I said, and they're like, no, you did it. I saw it. I'm crying. Or I laughed uncontrollably. And I'm looking back at it and I'm like, damn, but I still feel like something's missing. And then there's a moment where I get to say it out loud. And for some reason, the crowd's response to me will either tell me if I'm being too hard on myself or mm-hmm. if it's legit where it's at. And then the second tier of that is the news. Say if I've written something that was, you know, ripped from a headline and they're updates. Now I need to go back and those are the edits that I'm making, but it's not necessarily about my writing. It's just making the story more factual, right. more authentic, you know? And so in those moments, I'm like, damn, Roy, like, yeah, we did that.
That's dope. And I think, you know, it's important, I guess, for me, I wanted to ask that because I think so many artists, and it doesn't matter if you're a poet or whatever your art is, I think that we often are our own worst critics, right? Especially when you love what you do, right? Because you want it to be the best part of you. And so I think just from my own, I wanted to just know, you know, I know that you're dope. Like, I want to know that, well, does she know that she's dope? And I remember the first time I ever heard your poetry, I ever saw you, I learned who Roya was. And it was at an open mic at Capicu. I don't know if you remember that.
Brooklyn.
Yeah, but it was, I want to say it might have been 2013 or 2012 or something. And you came on the stage, and I can't remember the exact poem, but it was something like about candy and like M&Ms and Milky Way. And it was like these basic things, but I was like blown away. I was like, who is this? Like, and I was like, okay, I need to follow her on Facebook. I need to get connected. Right. But I want to ask you, what is your creative process like? Like, how do you decide what you're going to write and when you're going to write it?
So I will say pre-COVID-19, it was very different than what it is now. And it also varies depending on what state of mind I'm in, what the topic is. There are a lot of times where a thought or an idea comes to me, or even a line, which I might think is super meaty, and say I'm in the shower or I'm somewhere where I can't access my phone or a pen or paper. And I just have to keep repeating it over and over. And I can't talk to people and I can't focus or do anything else until I'm able to like jot that down. Outside of that, I'm really inspired by different films, TV shows, or life happenings, right? I've been home, so spending a lot of time with my partner, or when she's out, then it's the dog. Then right. it's, what gets me outside is either walking the dog or going to check the mail or maybe going to see my mom like once a month. So it's kind of like these moments where I'm factoring in how life has shifted. And so at this current juncture, my creative process is so sporadic. It's so random. It's at night It's usually 3 a.m., 4 a.m., and I can't close my eyes. So then I don't want to keep tossing and turning in the bed. So I'll get up and I'll come sit on the couch and I'll write for like 30 to 40 minutes. And then I'll go in the room and I'll like lay down, and it's probably like 6 a.m. now, and I'm trying to fall back asleep so that I can have some semblance of energy for the rest of the day. But also notes, like note taking. I have the Notes app, but I also have the Google Docs app. And it's like, if something comes, boom, I'm jotting that down. And maybe that'll take a day to write. Maybe it'll take a week, 2 weeks, a month. Or maybe when I jot that idea down, all this information, which is like informational as well as experiential, like it just starts coming. All of this data starts blurting itself out. Then there's its first form. So then I'm going back into it and seeing, you know, what statements, comments, cliches might exist that need to be erased. So then I'll get those out of there or figure out a way to turn them into some sort of metaphor where it doesn't sound redundant, right? Then I'm looking for the purpose, right? Making sure that this poem that's about my brother remains about my brother, and it's not about my father, or is about my brother's wife or his kids. This is his poem right here that I'm creating, right? Then I'm looking at it and I'm wondering why I wrote it. And I definitely spend time with that often, especially if I'm writing about people who are living and who might see it. I do a lot of work and thinking in terms of harm reduction because people have harmed me, and my goal is not to retaliate. My goal is actually to address, to process, to heal, right? And so when I'm considering those things, I'm looking at the piece and I'm like, huh, oh, I was ranting. All right, well, scratch that. Let's find out what the basis of this was, right? And then there's like those very rare moments, which I'm sure you've experienced, right? Where it's like, oh, this is gold as it is, right? Those moments where I send it to a friend and they're like, no, leave it. Like, leave it. But it's few and far between. That does not happen often. There are a lot of times where they're like, yo, the fourth stanza and the first stanza are the same thing with different words. Is that on purpose? And I'm like, no, not at all. I thought I was doing a thing. And they're like, right, the thing is not being done.
Are you tuned in? Because I am. It's the Nancy Ruffin Show.
Like, all right, cool. Well, which one should I remove? And then there's that moment, right? So.
Okay, so now I want to actually talk about the book, Daylight. Yes. First, it such a beautiful piece of work. And you touch upon, like, everything in this book. There's so many, like, just important themes in the book. What was the process of writing this book like? Was this something that had been, that you had been writing, you know, and then you just compiled the poems together, or was it very, very specific and intentional with the pieces that you wrote in here?
Yeah, I wish I could say that I had been writing and working. Nah, I was in a graduate program, and majority, I think there are probably four poems that didn't happen in that graduate program that are in this book. It was a traumatic experience. I can't even think of another way to phrase it. When you enter an institution, a place of learning, and you're surrounded by folks who have also entered this institution, this place of learning, but you have little to no idea what their intentions are. There was so much erasure, I think, in the space, and that's just within like classmates. And then beyond that, there was homophobia, there was transphobia, there was misogyny. It was wild. And I'm consistently looking around the room because I was always like, I feel like someone else should be saying something. Maybe the professor, maybe someone in the cohort, but it seemed like no one was saying anything, right? And so much like I was saying about therapy, right? I'm thinking about when the proper moment is. Like, am I a narcissist? Do I just want to draw all the attention? And it's like, at this moment, I just have to be like, Roya, no, this is problematic. And if no one's going to say anything, it is going to be you.
Right.
And I mean, moments like this person literally, we ended up finding out that they have a very tumultuous relationship that consists of abandonment and abuse with their own mother, who is a Black woman, and they weren't raised by Black people in their family. They were raised by the other side, which I am fairly certain was white. They said some of the most horrifying thing, especially because I would say maybe potentially they present as racially ambiguous, and you wouldn't get this person and immediately see they're a Black man, but knowing once they introduced themselves to you that they are Black, the things that they said were like Jordan Peele had written it. And I used to be like, sitting there sometimes in my mind, like, does this man not know And then realizing like he literally is choosing not to identify with this for a number of reasons, right? But at a certain point for me, I was like, okay, I'm gonna address these things. And then after I address these things, I'm just gonna get back to doing my work. Then when I got back to doing my work, I'm like, oh, I'm still addressing these things that happened in my work. There was no way for me to just center and focus on the kind of work, because it's like I'm teaching and facilitating in a class where I'm supposed to be being taught and facilitated to. And
that is heavy.
Yeah, there were issues, and I wasn't alone in this, right? There were several people, and by several, I mean three, right? There were three other people who were like, all right, like, you know, let's figure it out. Let's see what we're gonna do about it. Let's talk to this person, talk to that person. And it seemed as though a lot of the things that we were trying to address were falling on deaf ears. And or we were being placated, you know, people were like, oh, well, you can do this, or you can try that, or you can talk to this person. And it's like, I don't want to keep talking and talking and talking and talking. I'm telling you, there are actions, and they don't necessarily even need to be punitive, right? But if you have some sort of resources in place where there are mandatory conversations that we're having, right, to alleviate distress, or if we're taking moments to actually have these professors be trained in how to like handle these situations. You know, there was a moment where I had ended up, and I don't want to curse, but I'd ended up telling this man, like, yeah, just come on, come out, come outside. We're in class. We're on campus. Wow. I'm like, yo, just come. And everybody in the class now is like, and my homegirl is like, no, Roy Chen. I'm like, nah, but well, I'm finished. I'm actually finished. I'm done chilling. I did that. I attempted to chill. I am now frosted from chilling so hard. Now we need to go outside and handle it. And at that moment, the professor's like, oh, what I think is happening here is, and I was like, no, actually what's happening is I'm about to beat his ass. So I don't really know what you think is going on in this way, right? And then there's like this moment where they're like, hey, you know, we checked in with this person and he said he's feeling emotional about this, this, and this. And I'm like, huh, okay. And so for the last 3 months, when we were explaining the ways that we were literally being harmed from the violence, the verbal abuse that was coming out of this person's mouth, you never felt it important. Right. You never felt compelled to come check in with us, right? And so there were moments where I was looking at this catalog of work that I was building, and I'm just like, this has to be something other than a thesis. This has to be something greater than. And my thesis specifically was on Black butch visibility. When it came to the book, I started thinking about the ways in which I had been made to feel invisible for the entirety of my existence. And it had just exploded in this particular program, where I now had the tools to address, to assess, right? And have always, for the last few years, opted to use my pen, but had been literally pushed to wanting to use my fist, right? Oh. Then put my body in harm's way for my own safety. And how ironic is that, right? And so I was like, all right, now I've got these poems, what am I gonna do with them? And I wrote a Facebook status and I said, who's finna publish my manuscript? And there were so many people on there that were like, oh man, I don't know, can't help you, but I'll definitely buy it. Gonna get 3 copies, gonna get 12, gonna do this, gonna do that. And then a few people were like, well, send it over, we'll see what we can do. And one person who was a friend of someone I had actually gone to undergrad with was like, well, send it to me. I have a few friends, I'll send it around. And then read it and was like, I spoke to my boss and we were talking and I was like, why would I give this to someone else when we could do this right here? And I was like, all from Facebook.
Listen, people underestimate the power of social media.
It's me. I'm people.
That's you.
It's me. I am people.
Listen, and also just asking, right? We have such a hard time just asking for help or putting it out there. And all you did was, okay, who's gonna publish this? A simple one sentence, right?
I feel so bad too sometimes. I give whatever resources that I have, but people are like, oh my gosh, like I want to know about how to go. And I'm like, baby, I use my thumbs. I was on my cell phone and I had typed a Facebook status and I pushed publish. And then this all came into fruition, you know? So I'm like, I know that networking is a major part of it, you know?
It is. It so is. People under, you know, I have a love-hate relationship with social media. But I love it because of the way it's able to connect you to people that you otherwise would not be connected to, you know, like, especially now with this pandemic, when no one is going out, the only way you're really staying connected with people is through Zoom or through social media, you know, and it's important. And for whoever's watching, whoever's listening, it's not just enough to connect with them, clicking that follow button or friending them or whatever it is. But like, how are you engaging with that person and what they're doing and their work? Like, you have to be intentional about the connections that you're making.
Yes. Intentionality is, for me, it's number one. I was going to say top two, but it's two. It is literally number one. And that's something that I'm talking about all the time. I'm talking about intentions and I'm talking about integrity, especially when it comes to our writing, because there are only a few things that we're in charge of. We're in charge of our intentions and we're in charge of our delivery, but we cannot be in charge of how people receive and perceive
what
we have offered, right? And so if we pay very close attention to our intentions, we will really lock it in, and honestly, for the most part, receive the best response.
Absolutely. You know, and when you think about just like success, in the general term of the word, like, no one achieves success like in solitude, right? Like, the only way you can be successful at something is if you're impacting like someone's life. Really, when you think about what like success means, right? So if your book is a success, right? It's because it has touched so many people who have picked it up and have read it and have been moved and touched by your words. And then the only way that happens though is by building the community, right? By really connecting with your audience in a way that they feel connected to you.
That's a fact.
Right. And so, like, people, be intentional with those connections that you're making.
Yes.
You know, so in your book, I mentioned you explore themes, you know, like queerness, of course, Blackness, you know, womanhood, domestic violence. There was a piece that you wrote in reference to Emily B. and Tony, you know, to the words of Fabulous's, to the beat to Breathe, Brilliant. I'm a huge hip hop fan, so I was like, yes, I love this piece. And there's so many pieces that you write like that. You kind of like, they say ripped from the headlines, you know, and then you talk about it. But then there was another piece that for me was really powerful. And it's when you're talking about the third suicide attempt. I don't know if I even wrote the title here, but it was powerful in the way, because I think so many, especially young people, when they find themselves in situations that they feel are beyond their control and they don't know any other way out, or they can't see a light at the end of the tunnel. I think suicide is something that if you don't try it, you have at least thought about it.
Yeah.
You know, and I say that from personal experience. So how difficult was it for you to like hold that mirror up, you know, to look at yourself and then write that piece?
I would say that it is probably the most difficult, because I talk about conversations that I've had or writing pieces about issues that I've had with relatives, right? But it's easy to say you, they, right? Mm-hmm. When, like you said, you hold the mirror to yourself and you're like, okay, here's this moment. There are pieces that I've had to like retire that I was saying out loud, because in the beginning I felt something strong. And then towards the end of that piece's tenure, I felt like I was going to die. Even said the words, like collapsing, right? And so I think for me in 2015, I was preparing for the Woman of the World Poetry Slam. And my mentor at the time was like, yo, I mean, these poems are great. You know, you're a good writer, but none of them are personal or personal enough. And what are the stakes? Like, what's at stake for you? What do you serve to lose? And what do you gain from saying these things? And I looked at the catalog of work that I was offering up for that. And I was kind of like, oh, damn, like nothing. I'm literally talking about everyone else. And there's no intro to me, who I am or what brought me to these points. And so I had written a number of pieces about some of the most traumatic experiences in my life. And at that point, it felt like healing. It felt like awakening, talking about a history of childhood sexual abuse, right? Talking about this person that I thought I was going to marry, being harmed by a police officer and me doing nothing about it for a multiplicity of fears, but ones that I would never know if they were real or not, because I chose to do nothing, right? And so from there, it pretty much opened up a window, because I was going to say a door, but it's not that big. It's a window, right? Mm-hmm. Where I can allow myself to address these things and still be okay enough to lay down, and close my eyes and go to sleep and not fear that someone's gonna creep into my room, right? Or that I'm gonna have the worst nightmare ever and then be in the bed for 7 days, right?
Yeah.
And when I think about the looking into the mirror, it shifts into a photograph and I'm seeing an older person, a younger person rather. And I am this older, way more knowledgeable, a stronger being who is now comfortable saying that was wrong. And it wasn't just wrong, it was horrible. And it's okay for me to say that it was wrong, that it was horrible to myself, to anyone around me, to people who know you. I don't have to swallow it just because you're a good person to someone else or because someone loves you.
Right.
And that's to close personal relationships, but that's also to people's relationships with these celebrities and stars who they feel are beyond that or untouchable. I've never met Toni Nicole Wells, but I grew up with Barry. This thought process for a lot of folks who are like, I love him. That was the homie.
Right.
I can't believe it. Okay, but it happened.
Right.
You know, and we weren't there in that moment, but we saw it all playing out.
Right.
Right.
And it's so funny because I had forgotten about that.
Yeah.
Until I read your poem, and then I remembered it, and I remember it playing out on social media, and I remember seeing the Shade Room, you know, post it, like,
yeah.
And it happens every day.
Yeah.
Every day.
It doesn't just happen. It happens every day. And it's people we know.
Yes.
People we know suffering, right? And so a lot of people, which is what I tell my students about all the time, think like, oh, something has to hit close to home for it to be real or for us to care. And then I'm telling them like, no, y'all, like things hit close to home all the time and people still don't care. They come up with different reasons why this person must have done this, or maybe this person just isn't well, or there's a lot of stress going on. Okay, a lot of people are stressful. Not everybody is a murderer.
Right.
You know, and you can still love that person. You can still have some semblance of a relationship with that person, but you can't ignore that that happened, that this is the thing that they have done. And it will be a part of them forever. And to be honest, you knowing them, it will be a part of you forever.
Right.
There won't be a time where you think of this person and don't think of that scenario. Unless, of course, you suffer memory loss, right?
Yes.
Other than that, anytime you hear that name, you might hear a song from Barry White and you're like, damn, I knew a Barry once.
Yeah,
like it's that so way,
true.
You know.
It's so true.
And so it's like I consider these moments, especially, you know, I work with young people, like all of the things that they love and that they adore, and I don't want to poke holes in it, but I want them to be able to investigate, right, and to hold every artist, including themselves, their parents, people in their lives, right, to the same standards,
right,
because that scenario with Fabulous, much as a lot of the more recent things with like Louis Lanes, these other artists, like being swept under the rug is mind-boggling, because that's a good, or like, you know, I'm Black, people in my family, well, I'm not listening to R. Kelly because y'all said
this, okay, I know.
Then don't talk to me about it. How about that?
Listen,
we go our separate ways.
What, you can't take away his musical genius, like his talent, like
absolutely.
He has that. There's no debating that. But me, like you, I don't care how good his music is, I cannot support a man who and his whole career, all he's done is abuse women, young women, little girls.
Yeah.
You know, like as a mother, I definitely can't do it. Like,
right. And I could not ever comfortably step in the name of love knowing there are women in the basement. Like, they're right beneath the floor that I'm step, side and side on. No, right?
Yeah.
And it's a strange scenario because I am not aligned with the carceral system.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no definitive answer due to how long this country has been running the way it is running,
right,
what the alternatives are. There are only suggestions, there are only ideas, but there are academics who have literally dedicated their lives to trying to study and figuring out what the alternatives could be, right? But for me personally, when we get into those very small conversations, like we're saying, with our friends, with our relatives, who are like, oh, but separate the music, separate the art from the artist. And then I tell them, what about me?
What about me
saying all of these things happened to me in my life and they've been horrible, and making a career off of telling people about these things, and then going out and doing that thing.
Right.
Would you then play my poem and say, yo, I separate the poems from the assailant? Like, no, you wouldn't do that. You'd be like, damn, that star fizzled out. Like, it's a wrap for her, and rest in peace. And you're not listening to my shit. You're not teaching my shit in your class no more. None of that, you know? And so they like, oh, that's different. And I'm like, the only difference is that I'm not rich.
Right.
That's it. That's literally the only difference.
You know, and it's not funny, but ironic, because I don't know if you recently saw the Will Smith Fresh Prince of Bel-Air reunion, you know.
I haven't gotten to watch it yet. But
so, you know, it was impactful, because when you think about the impact that show had in the way that it was presented, where we saw, you know, this very wealthy family, you know, it was great for Black people, right? Yeah. And as I watched that, like, a part of me was like, wow, like, the Cosby Show had that same impact. And if it wasn't for the Cosby Show, we never would have had the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Yeah, or Family.
However, because of Bill Cosby, like, that show is forever tainted. Like, it will never be, you know, put in a spotlight. They will never celebrate it in that way because of what he did. And it sucks because of all of the other amazing actors that were in the show, you know? And so, in much the way that you're saying about, you know, R. Kelly, like, there's no way we can separate the art from the artist.
And it's so incredibly complicated, but you have to be suffering from some severe trauma in order to be lacking in the smallest ounce of compassion to be able to say anything that would defend these artists. And it's unfair for the other people who were on those shows.
Right.
Who end up, you know, living in the shadow of that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's so strange and heartbreaking for me to know regular working class people that are mad at people like me for my take. They're like, nah, but you don't understand what happened when I watched the episode where she went to the concert. And I'm like, no, I don't understand what happened to you because I probably wasn't born. But also, what I do understand is that episode could have transformed your entire life and your entire way of thinking. And that's beautiful. And you got what you needed from it. And it doesn't change that you got what you needed from it. But here we are now in this year, even though for so many years people knew what was going on and were saying nothing, right? Here we are now in this year where it's out in the open and you have a choice and you are still choosing.
Right.
We're still choosing bad thing.
Yes.
And that there are so many things culturally, historically that play into you choosing that patriarchy and all of the ills that come from it. You know, like there are so white supremacy, because I say all the time too, you know, not to pit one against the other, but as Black people, we do hold a very close lens on the things that affect us deeply and impact the way we live and survive. Realistically, white people have been doing this for centuries.
Right. Yes. But
we want to talk about what's popular for us. We don't sit at the dinner table and talk about all the things that the white people did. The white people sit at the dinner table and talk about all the things that the Black people and the POC did. Absolutely. But when we sit down, we talk about the ones who look like us. And so I'm like, I see it and I understand your contention with it. But at the same time, that doesn't mean what this person did is any less wrong.
Right. So true. And I've kept you far longer than I promised. And I haven't even got through any. I might have to do a part two because I have so many other questions for you.
You can definitely do that.
But I want to be respectful of your time. And so I guess before I end, you know, we end tonight, how can viewers and listeners, you know, copy a book? And I encourage you all to buy this beautiful piece of work. Support Roya. She's phenomenal. She's doing amazing work, not just in poetry, but as you've heard through the entire interview with our young people. And for me, there's never more important work than that because they are the future of this world. So how can people connect with you? How can they buy the book? And how can they support you?
Yes. So first and foremost, I'm on all social media as Champagne Poet. On Facebook as Roya Marsh. You could Google Roya Marsh or Champagne Poet and find a ton of information about me. Information I don't even want you to have is on the World Wide Web. You purchase the book. You can buy it from anywhere that books are sold, but it is my hope that you would support your local and hopefully Black Indigenous or POC owned bookshops, you can find those on bookshop.org. If you are a New York native or local Bronxite, you can definitely support the Lit Bar, which is in my home borough, yes. the BX, and owned by Noelle Santos, a Black woman. So please purchase that, support. I appreciate it. I have some new things coming out for the holidays, including posters. I definitely have signed copies of the book also. So if you reach me on any one of those social medias, you can get a personalized COVID-free signed copy from me. I'm available to do all types of things like podcasts and workshops and performances and keynotes, lectures, all the things.
That's good to know. I have a couple of things coming up on the pike. I might reach out to you to hire you, Miss Roya.
With it.
Because I think, again, thank you so much for just being on. Please stay safe and healthy. And hopefully we'll see each other sometime soon when it's safe, you know, and for us to get together.
Yes, thank you so much, Nancy. This was absolutely a brilliant conversation. I appreciate you.
I appreciate you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Nancy Ruffin Show.